Well, you think that's working in your favor right now?
At least grease it up a little bit.
No, I don't want him to enjoy it.
Oh, my God!
Welcome to TV Net's Flashcast for Sons of Anarchy. I'm Lisa Schmeiser, here as usual with Philip Mosalak, and we are going to give you the breakdown for this Tuesday's episode.
And what an episode it was.
One word, how would you describe it?
I want to say finally.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm watching Sons of Anarchy. Punchy. And I don't know what that means.
Well, there's a couple different takes. I think punchy is a great word for it because there is, of course, the very literal sense. And there was certainly a whole lot of that going on. And punchy is also used to describe a mental state where people are kind of loopy and a little overwhelmed because they're exhausted. And that's a great way to talk about the emotional state of all the people on this show. And punchy is also used in script writing or storytelling to denote something that's moving along at a speedy clip. And while we can't really say that for an season-worthy episodes of average 75 to 90 minutes apiece, I think we can say that for the speed with which plot lines have been set up and pushed into motion. So punchy is a great descriptor, Philip. Well done.
Well, you know, I mean, it just rolls right out of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so yeah, let's start off.
Yeah, you ready to put a minute in here?
Ready to put a minute in. I've got the timer up, and let me start recapping. All right, Gemma's lie goes big time as Nero learns, and so does everyone else, haha, that apparently the Chinese are the ones who put out the order to kill Tara and did this. Needless to say, this is news to Henry Lin as well, and he lets that be known. Jax and Nero have a confrontation over whether or not Jax is a lying liar that lies. It was unnecessary because the answer to that question for always and forever is yes. Meanwhile, on the home front, young Abel is beginning to show signs of taking after dear old dad, picking up a sledgehammer, and it was a weighted hammer, and threatening to bean anybody who came near his brother, much to the shock and horror, which is ridiculous, of Gemma and Wendy. And also, Gemma goes to drive Juice down to Mexico to kill him. He figures it out, manages to crash her car. This is like the second SUV she's crashed in three seasons. Mm-hmm. And the episode ends with them with a tense standoff. Will he kill her? Of course not. But it's fun to think for a minute that he might. There
dun,
we go.
Dun, dun.
Yep. Yeah. I have to admit, I thought the ending was kind of BS. Just because, again, you know that Gemma's not going to get killed off.
Right.
And the only thing that could possibly happen at this point is that she shoots Juice. But the previous runner would give it away. And even then, she's crazy and she's desperate, but is she honestly crazy and desperate enough to shoot Juice and then to try to come up with a bunch of lies to explain to Unser and Wendy why she did that? I mean, they already have plenty of reason to distrust her, and getting rid of Juice would only amplify that at this point.
Yeah. This was the only part of the episode that I didn't see the telegraph.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just because I kind of was a little shell-shocked, like, really? We're doing another car crash?
Yeah.
And that really kind of bothered me, but I it's only through watching it now three times that that's kind of bothered me.
Ah.
But with, you know, Juice is a smart guy. And, like, the murder he commits inside the hotel room kind of shows us, look, He's still got his edge, and he knows, you know, how to play people, and he gets Gemma in a lie, and then says, "This is how I know now." And
I was actually surprised he caught out the lie, just because one of the things that I think has always driven his character is his desperate need to be part of a bigger family.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the reasons that he went off the rails in the first place is because Jax shamelessly abused that when he had him kill Darvini.
Yeah.
And another, and let's face it, that's also the reason that Clay leaned on him so hard, too, was because it takes anybody in that club literally 10 seconds to figure out that Juice is desperately trying to belong to somebody, anybody. And the best way to get him on your side is to give him that sense of belonging and acceptance, and then make it highly conditional, because he'll do anything to keep it.
Right. And he even says, again, part of his character. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I can't be alone.
Yeah.
And what Sheriff
Roosevelt.
Yeah. Used that to the nth degree.
Although when you think about it with Roosevelt, what I was about to say is, although he leaned on him hard, and that was, and I think a lot of fans may be predisposed against Roosevelt because he's introduced as somebody who very coldly assesses the members of the Suns, picks out a vulnerability, and then threatens to exploit it. And, oh, it pushes Juice to try to commit suicide, da, 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 da. But one of the things I liked about the show was the way it showed Roosevelt gradually understanding the scope of what he was doing and trying to make it up and offering Juice something as close to, you know, a genuine connection as Juice was going to get.
Yeah, I never had a problem with it. I mean, it was interesting because it built tension and it connected me. So that's why I enjoyed that struggle. Now, coming down the pipe, what does Juice have now? He has absolute leverage. He can leverage Nero with, do you want Gemma to die? Yeah. He can leverage against Jax and Gemma by telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wanted a way back in, which he clearly stated, did he state it to Chibs?
No, I think he wanted a way in with Chibs. And Chibs made it clear that, no, I have no relationship with you outside of the club.
Right.
And please go shoot yourself now.
Right. So I don't know. But either way, he's got a couple different outs with either freedom or possibly some sort of trade for a life, maybe even inside the club. But I think that's drawing way too fine a point.
I don't think Juice is ever going to be back inside the club. And the reason I say that is at the end of the day, Gemma is just the den mother. And while Jax leans on her, he's not going to let her override his decision to kill Juice. It's just not going to happen. I honestly think that there are some lines that Jax refuses to let his mother cross.
Yeah.
So, you know, Gemma, I think you've got leverage from the Nero angle, but that's about it. And the problem with Juice trying to use Nero, Gemma as leverage is that Nero would just as soon kill Juice. I mean, this is almost a win-win as far as Nero's concerned. So I feel so bad for Juice because he's just been doomed from the word go. I mean, the fact is that they made it clear that he fell into the motorcycle gang because he literally had nothing else.
Right.
I mean, you know, he was bored and got in trouble back east, moved out west to stay ahead of his trouble, ended up in some crap old charming town. And I'm still not clear how he got there. I don't think they've ever actually explained that.
Well, but it seems as though he has a business.
Well, he's got a business, but how did he get? I guess the thing is when you move from New York City out to the West Coast, how do you end up in a town that is so small that Stockton is your metropolitan area? And typically the answer is that you have friends or family there. So the only thing I can guess is that Juice drifted from Oakland to Stockton and then somehow ended up in Charming because he got tied up with the club. But, you know, there was a scene, I can't remember it had to be season 4, where they're trying to run down Juice for something. And they're like, well, he has no family here. He has no friends here. There's an ex-girlfriend he sees from time to time. And it just points out that this kid literally has nothing outside the club. And, you know, and it explained a lot about his motivation, but it just goes to show how tiny Juice's world is. And really, he's got no chance.
He's burned.
It's a beautiful commentary on how shaky the social net is for a lot of young people who grew up in broken homes and without a solid community.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Juice is basically the story behind almost every mugshot you see.
But I'll tell you what, even if everything was on the up and up, going to Mexico, it's like, I'm just going to another country and I'm going to be by myself. I mean, I couldn't even see, like, right there where he was kind of like, well, I don't want to do that.
Well, no, because he was supposed to be going north. The story that Gemma told him originally was, well, I'm taking you north so you can hide out at my dad's place for a while. And then presumably, I guess he'd resume life as an Oregon pot farmer or whatever. And then when he notices they're driving south, Gemma's like, oh, ha, ha, story's changed, Nero Coyote. And that's when the penny dropped that Gemma was never really going to help him. She just wanted to get it out of town before she killed him. And went from there. But really, to be honest, that was kind of the least interesting part of the episode for me. I mean, it's got it's the cliffhanger because he's got a gun on her and everything. But we know that Gemma's either going to cry or talk her way out of this one.
Right.
And Juice is going to bargain his way into a situation where there is some final confrontation and he's going to blurt out that he's the one who killed Roosevelt because he caught Gemma killing Tara. At this point, I suspect that Juice will squeal. Everyone will discredit it because, oh, he's a traitor to the club and blah, blah, blah. And it will never hit any of these rocket scientists later that the reason that Juice ended up in the situation he was in was precisely because he's telling the truth. So
I almost makes me wonder if within the final minutes of this season, Gemma mm-hmm. comes clean to Jax and then fade to black.
She never gains anything from that.
Right, but it gives us that big cliffhanger that we'll never know what exactly happened.
I don't know. I mean,
he's going to have to find out.
Sutter is huge on punishment, though. I mean, because this is the thing, is he was pretty clear in interviews that Tara was going to die from season one. He's like, the minute she threw him with Jax and had Jax kill her boyfriend, she had made her decision, and she was always going to have to die as a consequence of her decision. So, you know, and he's been pretty clear telling a story here that Gemma is an incredibly toxic force who has managed to pretty much single-handedly ruin a small town. And she's responsible for the deaths of dozens of people. And he's also making it clear that Jax has a huge price to pay, too. I'm asking myself, what is the ending where the two of them are finally wrestling with the karmic balance of what they owe the universe? And, you know, my contention is always going to be that Jax ends up in jail and that Gemma ends up with no club and working the night shift at a gas station, you know, never sees her grandsons, doesn't have the club, that kind of thing.
And certainly doesn't have Nero.
Oh, no, no. Nero is either dead or out of there.
Yeah. Well, and that was the speaking of Nero, that was mm-hmm. really the part that telegraphed really, at least for me, I don't know about other people watching, but it's like Nero wasn't gonna fold. It was a good mm-hmm. trick against the Chinese to get Lin all revved up. And I have to say, like, we're going again by like one particular lie that Gemma has told. Now mm-hmm. we're in episode 5 with that lie still going on. Now, that's not something.
And Lin is like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Think, man, why would I do that? So,
and then obviously this is leading up where Jax is going to. I think it was Bobby who said we'll get him on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I would assume that that's where we're going to have Tully doing a big play on them.
Yes, yes. I kind of hope that Lin survives. I like Lin. I should put that out there right now. I like him. He's organized. For him, it's actually business first. And I think the way that he's responding to a series of incomprehensible and seemingly unprovoked attacks is genius. I think one of the things the show has showed us, has demonstrated for us so far this season, is that Jax has gone out of his head. And frankly, in this state where his higher faculties have gone to grieving or whatever. Frankly, in the state, he's easily overmatched by both Lin and by, help me out, Pope's second in command. Who is that?
Oh, Marx.
Marx, yeah. Because both Marx and Lin are incredibly intelligent businessmen, and they are capable, like, they let their emotions, they are capable of using their emotions to drive a bigger picture. Whereas what Jax does is Jax tends to do exactly the opposite, where he tries to bend the picture to fit his feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's trying to do here. And Lin and Marx operate in exactly the opposite direction, and they've both been around for a lot longer. So, to be honest, at this point, I'm rooting for them.
Well,
I think it wouldn't hurt for Jax to learn that lesson. I don't think it hurts for the club to learn that lesson, to be frank. And one of the things that has always seemed to be thrumming in the background of the show is that these guys are fossils. You know, like their brand of racist small-time crime is a relic of a much earlier era. And, you know, in many ways, it kind of parallels the decline of blue-collar jobs and all that's been going on over the last 20 to 25 years, too. But this is basically, you're watching the waning days of an empire here.
Well, and exactly. And Jax gave it all up for, you know, once he was out with the Irish, that was their main mode of income. And that was, like, really what put them on the map.
Yeah.
And without having that, and frankly, not having a mechanic error, you know, having any kind of real, like, legitimate business.
Except, well, they've got Red Woody now.
That's true. Of course, everybody's dead.
Well, no. Just the hookers were dead. That was Diosa. Red Woody are porn actresses, and one presumes that there might be some overlap between the Diosa Norte girls and the Red Woody girls, but there may also be girls who only do one or the other. So yeah, I think the reason Lila was just kind of devastated was because she had been trying to move over to the madamly side of things, and she had, you know, she probably knew some of these girls, which is why she was just, you know, a wreck in the episode.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting, so there was an interesting moment I wanted to get your take on. There's a moment where, again, Gemma is comforting Lila, and, you know, I'm patting her back and whatever, and Jax comes in, and Jax sees that Lila is devastated, and he goes for her. And Gemma waves him off with, I've got this. And they, you know, there's clearly some attention paid to that moment and that interaction, and it's one of the first measures of genuine concern Jax has shown for anybody in this season. And it really struck a chord with me. And I don't think it's because Jax loves Lila romantically per se, but there's something going on there.
Well, now you say that, and then I thought where you were going to go was with that kind of emotional kiss on the cheek that he gave Wendy.
Yeah.
Now, going back from our last episode, we were talking about Jax and his basically how he's Charlie, how he's playing Jax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he seemed to be slightly at least giving some sort of emotion.
Yeah.
In this one. However, when he talks
to you.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I have two theories. One is about Borofsky and one is about who's the guy from Indian Hills?
Oh, Jury.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, how false do those, like, scenes with Jax and Abel read?
I'm looking at the clock here because, you know, you and I try to keep this hard. We try to keep the podcast fast and focused. And I'm all, how much time do I have to rant about this? In the history of this entire series, there has been one exchange between toddler Abel and Jax that I have enjoyed. One. And it was the sequence in the hospital where, and this is after the car accident, where Jax wakes up and Abel is standing by his bed and grinning at him, and they have a discussion over whether or not Abel can have cookies for breakfast. And I think that exchange works in part because Charlie Hunnam is relaxed and smiling and playful. It's like earlier in that season, there's a sequence where Tara's holding baby Thomas, and when Jax goes to kiss her, the baby lifts his face up too, and Jax just leans down and kisses the baby. And I like that because I think it was Charlie Hunnam kind of riffing on the moment with, you know, this little kiss lifting his head, isn't that sweet? And, you know, it implies great affection, but this whole with Abel is asking uncomfortably on point questions thing that was going on in this week's episode. No, did not care for it at all.
Okay. That's what I thought. I almost would prefer them just to cut those kind of scenes because we haven't had to deal with it. And I don't think we should at this point. It just,
yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm not where I do And to be fair, it's probably really hard to find an actor who is a preschooler. And I say this because I have a kid who's about Abel's age in real life. And I'm around them a lot now, thanks to playdates and things like that. And getting a 3-year-old to act lively and vibrant and take direction is like asking a group of cats to get up and do the can-can and syncopation. It's it's not going to happen. And so you have to have kids who are easygoing and can take direction well. And those kids exist, but they tend to be kind of mellow, self-contained kids. And that can read as something is off. Like in real life, it doesn't read that way, but like on camera, it can read that way. Yeah. And so they have a kid who can hit his marks as an actor, and Charlie Hunnam, bless his heart, is doing the best he can to you know, do the damaged dad thing here. But at the same time, you are talking about, this is a 3-year-old. They have temperament. They can only work so many hours a day.
But that quote, "Are you okay, little man?" That's all I've heard this season, and it's really dull.
Oh yeah, well, he's not bringing his A game as a father. We know that.
Right.
To me, interesting, and I use the word interesting in the broadest possible interpretation, the more interesting interpretation was that Abel immediately went to protecting Thomas. Like, he grabs a hammer because he knows what to do with it, and he blocks it off so nobody can get to Thomas, and he's swinging the hammer wildly. And what kills me is both Wendy and Gemma seem surprised by this. And I'm like, do you know who his father is? Do you know who you have taking care of him 12 hours a day? Come on. You cannot have this kid around and not have him internalize that, you know, these kids are sponges at this age. Everything comes up. Like when my daughter play acts, like what she'll do is she'll play act, quote unquote, work sometimes, where she pulls up her little table and she'll get out a paper and start writing. And then every once in a while she'll say, I can't talk, I'm on deadline. Because because she's heard that from us.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, they pick up everything, like whether or not you want them to. And so clearly Abel's picked this up, and they're also telegraphing what's going to happen with the Courtney Love plotline, where Abel is probably going to wail on some kid at school, and there's going to be an awkward confrontation between Courtney Love, and people will look really worried that Abel's damaged for a while, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, like, this whole scene, that I get the feeling that the whole point to Abel's acting out this week was to show that everything Jax and Tara were trying to do for the last 3 years, it's not working. It's futile. And this kid is going to be permanently on a bad road if daddy doesn't do something in a hurry.
And he's not. So,
yeah, I mean, this is just a way of tightening of upping the dramatic stakes again.
Okay. Well, speaking of dramatic stakes, which I think these are my conjectured notes. Borofsky kills the detective or the cop that's doing the that is perceived to be the leak that got a strange phone call to stay away from the warehouse.
Okay.
Borofsky kills him really fast. Now, is that to cover his trail because he's the one? Possibly.
Ooh, I hadn't thought about that. That's a great conjecture.
Right. When you kill somebody too soon and then Jack says, I didn't want him dead yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That tells me there's something to that. Or jury, one of those two guys that was that had ripped off the Chinese is his son or his half son. Something. Because there's
something along those lines.
He's connected in some capacity.
Oh yeah,
and no, he's flipped.
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure which one's legit.
It could be both, for all we know.
That's true.
The whole theme for this, one of the themes that comes up again and again, is everyone talks a big game about trust, but everybody proves utterly untrustworthy on some level, and. You know, Borofsky has no interest whatsoever in protecting anyone's interest beyond his own.
Well, and his best girl was killed.
Yeah, yeah. He was remarkably understated with that one.
Very understated.
But worries me.
Most of these guys, yeah, exactly. They can keep their emotions in check, like Lynn, like Marks. Oh, and these guys are professionals.
Yeah.
And somehow Jax is an absolute mastermind. And yeah,
I don't buy that anymore just because.
No, I don't either. It's like, but this yeah. the whole concoction of hitting the Chinese the way they did, that's so many different pieces in motion that mm-hmm. it just doesn't work. It is with a group that small, how in the world can they get that done?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's part of my problem right now. It's like, you look at all Lin's crew. They've it's like double of the Suns.
Yeah.
Triple.
Yeah. There's, and I don't think it's going to be when they're going to triumph against the odds because that's what they do. They're the Sons of Anarchy.
See, that's the other thing. You have Chibs, who's now in love, or at least
I don't
something's
know.
Going on.
The thing that intrigues me about what's going on between Chibs and Althea I think it's the first time we've ever actually seen the implication that the dudes are having sex to further an agenda. Well, because they, you know, we knew that they were comfortable ordering the Crow Eaters to do it. Cause there's mm-hmm. a whole plot line in season one where there's a Crow Eater who, like, well, they need something from the creep down at the crematorium, and the only way they can get it is to get a Crow Eater to have sex with him, and then the only way she'll have sex with him is if she gets to have sex with Jax first. He's like, the things I have to do for the club, Crow Eater, ha-ha! Because he would have had sex there anyway, obviously. But, you know, I find it hard to believe anyone said to Chibs, you know, take off that shirt and strut for sheriff. But, I am not clear on why he thinks it's a good idea to have a sexual relationship with her. And I'm not clear on what either one of them are thinking when it comes to that.
Well, and let's be honest, the mm-hmm. way in which they were introduced to each other, like was almost porno. Hey, Scotty, I'm down with you. Let's go. You know, it was, mm-hmm. there was again, so much stuff that we didn't see that we're not going to because we've never gone back in time. And it's like, wait a minute. So you guys are like an item from the word go. And cause she was calling him Scotty, like with a kind of a little smirkiness.
I think that was her throwing him off his game, you know, or trying to anyway, and letting him know that, oh, I'm not like other sheriffs. I'm capable of having a sense of humor or some such BS like that. Like, this was, he's different or what have you.
Is she playing him?
That would seem to be the implication, wouldn't it?
I could go for that. I can't see Chibs. I can see Chibs falling for her and getting messed up and mm-hmm. her exploiting that twisted anxiety
that said,
in him.
That said, I have a feeling that the only quote unquote genuine romance we see this year is between Tig and Venus.
You're damn right.
It's beautiful too.
I was trying to explain it to my wife. I said, you know, there's something about this. I know it should be gross, but for some reason it's not. And Tig's also had the quote of the absolute episode.
Yeah, just gay enough.
That's right. I'm just gay enough. Before he put a flute up a bum hole.
Like I said, he's never going to march in a pride parade with a sign that reads, I love my transgendered wife or whatever. But
if you're not nice to her, I'm going to kill you.
Oh, yeah. No. Tig remains far and away my favorite character on this show.
I know. We talked about it, and I didn't realize he was. Yep. All this time, I thought it was Chibs, but it's not. It's Tiggs.
Chibs is more of a dirtbag than I thought he was, if that makes sense. Because, you know, in the early seasons, you see him as, he's sad because he's a pest. He's got a wife and a daughter that Jimmy won't let him see. And that's like a whole hot mess. And he helps Tara because he had some experience as a field medic before he was drummed out of the army. And he seems to be kind of the grown up and, you know, he's a surrogate father figure. And then as we progress deeper into the series, Well, he has a wife and a daughter, and even after, like, Jimmy was removed as an obstacle, we see it was never really about Chips wanting to get his family back, because he's never made a move in that direction, and they've never come over to see him. And, you know, at this point, he was killing Jimmy O just because, like, his feelings were hurt. And then we see that his attitude towards Juice was highly conditional and somewhat mercenary. And now he's having things going on with the sheriff for reasons that are intensely opaque. And I think, he's kind of problematic, you know?
Well, I mean, it's easy if you're Kurt Sutter and then you decide, well, I needed that storyline with Chibs,
yeah,
but now I don't. So Chibs, go and have fun.
Yeah.
And that's not good storytelling, because if you're going to, you know, basically the payoff would be that they get to, something happens with them.
Yeah. Well, there was a line again, and I want to point out that during season three, I had literally just had a baby. So a lot of season three feels like a fever dream, because I was sleeping in like 90-minute shifts, and it was just, yeah, no, it was extended sleep deprivation. Everyone complains about like the Ireland story and the Irish storyline, and I'm all, nope, that's just a weird dream I had, you know? Like, the last coherent episode I remember is when they fly off to Ireland, and then I sort of snapped out of that haze around the season finale.
Does everybody kind of not like that? Like, hate that season?
Almost everybody I've talked to has been like, oh, season three, oh god, the Irish interlude. And
see, I didn't mind it at all.
But the one thing that stood out for me is Gemma makes reference to Fiona, who's Chib's old lady, and she's like, oh, she scares even me.
That's right.
And dude, I have been waiting for 3 years for Fiona to set foot in Charming and to find out why this is the case. Like,
well,
Gemma
came to the hospital when he got hit in the head.
Yeah, yeah. And then she like left again. So what the what?
I know.
Why isn't she staying with her husband? It just makes no sense. And
you would think that she's like the mad bomber. Like, she's just got like the crazy skill level of making bombs out of coffee cups.
Yeah. So it's just, it makes no sense. And it also points out one of the glaring weaknesses in this show, which is that Gemma never had an adversary who was as bad as she was.
That's true.
You know, she's never met her, you know, she's never met anybody where it was a fair fight.
Well,
and it would have been
be
nice
honest,
if
though,
Fiona had been a fair fight, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, and Tara kind of was able to do some of the conniving. Like, she was getting her game on before she got a fork in the head.
Oh, God, that just makes me so sad. Like, that whole, the whole Gemma-Tara relationship makes me so, so sad.
And that may be what's wrong with this season.
Yeah.
Whether I want to admit to it or not, I think that may, that offset female has not, there, no one has taken her place.
Yeah. Well, and that's, and I like this show a lot. And always have, but you know, and I will argue until I'm blue in the face that one of the most rewarding and fascinating show relationships between women over the on TV over the last few years was the Gemma Tara one. But I think that the writers did not perceive or create very many opportunities to build out a good bench of secondary female characters. It would have been nice to see how Lila and Tara went from polite, hello, I see you too are a fellow human who also enjoys bikers type of relationship to the near friendship that they had by the end of it. It would have been nice to see how that developed and to see what, you know, how it developed, like what caused who to change their mind. It would have been nice to see back channel scheming between other creators and basically have a deep bench of women characters that so that you understood a little bit more of the dynamics, and that just never came up. Most of the women who have come on the show have always come on in the context of what they can do for or with the men, or how they're going to eventually get smacked down by Queen Gemma, like, you know, Nero's poor crazy half-sister.
Right.
It's, and that's been a fundamental weakness of the show is that there's only one Queen Bee.
Well, and honestly, this is probably one of those situations where a guy writer sometimes just doesn't know how to write for women. Now he knows how to write for his wife, but you know,
let's not confuse that with writing for women.
Exactly. That's it's two different things. And I think you absolutely nailed it with, there is a very sluggish bench.
Yeah.
And now we're kind of suffering for it. And now we're getting piecemeal of new women characters, but though, are they going to be defined? Probably not.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, it was, and there was potential there, you know, Colette, long RIP.
That one, I was sure that was going to be one, because Gemma, you know, there was an obvious connection between them, sort of. But of course, it was like in one episode, I don't like you. Well, no, I think I do like you. And then you're dead.
Yeah. But, you know, it's the show, and honestly, this could be another podcast. It's got a really problematic relationship with female authority figures in general, because, you know, look at how they treated Saul for three seasons, whereby by the third season, because by the first, remember, in the first season, she's kind of a hard ass and she's vaguely unethical, but, you know, Lord knows she's better than crazy ATF agent who gets killed. But by the third season, like, she's completely off the reservation. She's scheming to have her girlfriend killed. She's totally corrupt. And, like, they turned her into a cartoon villain. And then you have CCH Pounder's character, who has disappeared because the actress has to go be on a CSI franchise. But
oh, is that why?
Yeah, that's why.
Oh my gosh! So no wonder there's something off.
But she can only commit to, I think, 7 episodes this season, so they're using her pretty carefully. But you know, they were really, oh, she plays fast and loose with the law because she's filled with righteous burning anger. And Margaret, the hospital administrator, like, this show really has a problem with women in straightforward positions of authority. And they've used it, and they've basically used Gemma to make their point about, oh, you know, women who are in positions of authority are you know, terrible abusers of power and not very nice people, and da-da-da. And, you know, this is my complaint about Althea as a character, too, is we haven't really gotten much of a chance to figure out why she is the way she is, but what we know about her is that she bangs people she's supposed to be arresting, and she takes bribes, and she justifies it by saying it helps her do her job better, but, like,
we have and smokes a little dope on the side.
Yeah, but why? Why does she do any of that
exactly?
Stuff? And it's just, you know, it's one of the, it is sad to me that the two most nuanced and perhaps noblest women on this show, one of them is transgender,
right,
and the other one is dead. So I'm beginning to find that a little off-putting. I mean, you know, kudos to making Gemma this multi-dimensional monster you can also pity and so on and so forth. But, you know, in terms of a bench of women characters, Sons of Anarchy's got a lot to do before they can catch up, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know if it can happen this season.
It's not going to happen. That's going to be a fundamental weakness in the series.
And sadly, now I say this, sadly, that's what's going to be known for is well, it was great up to season 6, and then that last season, well, it was hit and miss.
Yeah.
And we're halfway through almost at this point, and we have way more misses on the roster.
Yep. Well, we're at, what was this, the 5th episode?
Yeah, we'll be at 6 next week.
Yeah, well, the way these guys historically go is there's kind of a slowish first act where you're like, I don't know where this is headed. And then the second act, they keep moving the furniture around and there's a little bit of wrap up from act one. And you're like, I don't know. And then by act three, like, the dominoes start running into place. And you're like, how's this going to work? And that's why, like, they've gone to the press right now with, oh, there's a major character death in episode 9. Like, I've seen that all over the place. And I get the feeling that what they're doing is they're saying, all right, you know what, we're still moving furniture around. We're setting up the stakes where you're beginning to see where everything's unraveling and falling apart. And come episode 9 through episode 13, your hair will be on fire.
I'm willing to say yes, because it so far I've never been disappointed.
Yeah.
So maybe it's one of those situations where – once we see it all and we take a step mm-hmm. back, we're like, oh, what were we thinking? Well, yeah. that's not going to be exactly true because I think we're pretty smart on that. But stepping back from it, I think it's going to work.
I'm looking forward to seeing where I'm really wrong.
Exactly.
I mean, it makes me sad that I've been very wrong about Rat, because I honestly thought that would be a great reveal, where it turns out that the super competent guy who happens to always be in the right place at the right time and has done things like, oh, Jax, I just fixed the saddle bikes on your bag and that stuff, has been like secretly bugging Jax for 3 years, and oh, surprise, no, that would be great, because it would just be like, look, these meatheads in the street can scheme all they want, but at the end of the day, there's always someone who outthinks you. Like, that would have been great. It's a pity it's not going to happen now, because we see that Rat is clearly just,
Oh, he's fully in. Yeah, he's indoctrinated.
It's not just that. It's the fact that he's all hung up on the 18-year-old girl. And
that's weird.
Unless it's going to come down to, well, he was one of our best agents until he went rogue and began banging teenagers, unless that's where this is going, we can pretty much count Rat out as a covert agent, which makes me kind of sad.
Now, the only way that works in my mind is if they bring back the creepy federal agent. I loved him.
Lincoln Potter.
Exactly.
He was so great.
Let's just say, speculate, if we mm-hmm. could have Rat driving down, off campus.
And then you see that he knows Potter. Oh,
exactly.
Oh my God.
Now that would be cool.
You've made me so happy. Oh my goodness.
That would be awesome. Because he's a character that should have, he either had to die, but the way he went out was so awesome.
Oh, no, when he does it and the mayor's like, why are you doing this? And he's like, because I don't like you. Oh,
right. I don't like people.
No, he didn't like the mayor. He said that like explicitly.
That's right. That's right.
He's like, because I don't like you. Like, he liked Roosevelt. So
yeah. And he was honestly like if you're going through town, he was the honest man.
Yeah. Yeah. The one honest man.
He was the greatest.
He was so angry when his little sting didn't work either. Oh God, no! It's Potter was great, and if there is a scene where it turns out that Potter and Rat know each other, you will hear the shriek from where you are in Texas.
I'm in North Carolina, so I'll have to move.
Why did I think you were in Texas?
I don't know.
Why did I think that?
I don't know.
Is it the film thing? Because you have the film podcast and there's so many film buffs in Austin?
I don't know. I don't know. It could have been. Maybe.
Yeah.
Side note. What are we going to do?
Yeah. But no, you'll hear me shrieking all the way on the other, all the way on the other coast. How about that?
And it will actually have gone around the world and hit me.
Probably, yes. Yeah, I'd be like, wait, whoops. Oh my gosh, Lisa must have just watched the episode.
Right.
Oh my God, I wish they could bring back Potter.
There's no reason why they can't. There's zero reason.
They're no longer tied up with the cartel anymore. So they could have some whole, the cartel thing is done, so now we can move in on the Sons of Anarchy and the Irish. Ha ha ha.
That's right.
Because, the other thing is I find it hard to believe that after 6 years of God knows how many law enforcement agents trying to bring down this motorcycle gang for everything from looking at policemen funny to running weapons and drugs, they're like, oh, well, we're done. No more. Uh-uh. No, because at this point, since these dudes have gotten out of prison, in the 3 months they've been out of prison, which encompasses the last three seasons, in like the 3 months they've come out of prison, they've been out of prison, like nearly 100 people have died at their hands.
Yeah.
You're telling me that law enforcement agents haven't been patiently waiting for this and they're like, look, these guys are technically still on parole, but I'd like to point out that they left jail on June 18th, and since then we've been averaging 25 extra homicides a day in San Joaquin County or whatever.
And let's be honest, when you're a convict and mm-hmm. you get released, you are not to go around other convicts.
Yeah. And yet these guys all hang out together and all that stuff. But, you know, I find it hard to believe. And again, it's been less than a few months. Surely there is a way for Lincoln Potter to have worked his way back into the case somehow.
Look.
Or I mean, ATF or any of that. So.
Yeah, it's surprising because he could have even used Jax in jail to formulate RICO again. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But or he comes back and he's given up the badge and he just wants to become a member.
Oh my gosh.
Because he does ride a bike.
This is true.
But now, he doesn't like people.
Oh God. My God, I would love it. Now you have me imagining the Rat and Potter together, and that's just going to make me happy for the rest of the night now.
Well, you can write the fan fiction on that one.
No, I cannot. Oh my gosh, no. It would be all federal law statutes.
That's right.
Okay, so your predictions for what happens next episode?
I almost thought the truth might come out, but it's too big of a lie to come out at this point. However, it does mark episode 6, which puts us at the halfway point.
Yeah.
Now, my feeling is that it's going to be a Nero, Gemma, Juice triangle, and Nero is going to find out the truth.
Interesting.
That's the only thing I can definitely give you, and that's because I did not watch the previews for next episode.
Ah, okay. I did, and I'm glad I kept my mouth shut. Because I think you are right about Nero and Juice coming face to face again.
Okay.
And I'm not giving anything away from the promos when I say that. And I think there's a Nero Juice discussion on the horizon. I'm curious to see if Abel's problems continue, because I think they will. And I want to see how Gemma manages to make it back home and explain how she ended up, how she came to be in Southern California instead of, you know, Oregon, where she's ostensibly checking on her dad.
Yeah, but that's getting all covered up by Nero. Guaranteed.
Yeah. Oh, he's the worst.
Because yeah,
he's not, but he shouldn't enable her like he does. Anyway.
But he's now trusted because he did what he did. Mm-hmm. He's got the clout. He's the OG.
Okay. All right. Well, I have to go back to thinking warm and happy thoughts about Rat and Potter.
Definitely.
And it's getting late on your end, too.
Right. It's time for me to do some Photoshops of those two.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Will do.
All right.